I don't know about you, but every morning I wake up before coffee, before talking to anybody, before thinking about anything, I pick up my phone. I engage in the internet. I engage in the digital. I've been asking myself one question all year long. How does internet, our digital landscape, influence the things we do and change the way artists and makers interface with the world?
This is Script, a multi-platform art project that consists of a podcast, publication, and exhibition. Join us as we interview artists, talk to them about their practice, and ask them how the digital has influenced their world.
Hey guys, welcome back to episode 6 of Script. This is our final episode for the Script series. That doesn't mean we're not going to be doing podcasting anymore. We've got a lot of great feedback, so we'll be back to join you guys. We'll just reformulate it a little bit. We'll work on gathering some new content, and we will be recording all fall so that we can be back for your listening January 2020. Super excited about that. But for this episode, for this final episode, what's happening is it's leading up to an exhibition of all the artists we've talked to. It'll be their work in the gallery at Carnation Contemporary on June 1st in Portland, Oregon. So if you're in the area, if you've loved what you've listened to, or if you just are curious about what kind of work these artists make, if you want to visualize it, really get a visual example, come out June 1st from 6 to 9 for the opening of the Script exhibition. Today, I'm talking with artist Leslie Vijun. In this episode, we talk a lot about thresholds or access points or sort of material ideologies, like how we break down or unpack materials that surround us. So I've just asked Leslie about her practice, what it looks like, what we can expect to see within her work, what kind of visual cues is she using? And we're going to go ahead and roll right into that conversation with her answer. All right, let's listen.
My work is, like I said, it ranges kind of substantially from show to show, which isn't something I ever expected. But I think that things that are universal across my work is it's generally graphic. And I don't mean designerly necessarily, but I think that there are a lot of like graphic elements to my work. I do use a lot of saturated colors. So if it's oil paint or light or digital prints, it doesn't really matter, but I think that there's always kind of a high saturation of color. I'm really interested in power clashing and that and layering and texture.
Yeah.
A lot of my work is 2D and then set into some kind of an installation. Something I really think about in my work is this idea of the threshold and having viewers enter a space, having to have a moment of walking through something. So I'll use a lot of the time light, fog, scale, entrances, foyers, different situations that I can create. So it's almost like an Alice in Wonderland effect, I think. Yeah. Or I think if you think about just like that movie trope where somebody like walks into a room and like the record stops, almost like the opposite of that, where it's like they walk into the room and something happens.
Yeah, it's
like all of a sudden it's different. And I don't think that just merely walking through a door normally stimulates that kind of a shift. So yeah. I think that something that I try to focus on in my work is really making that engagement happen.
What's so funny is, I mean, you were talking about Alice in Wonderland, and I love this idea of thinking about the threshold.
Yeah.
But you're totally right, like, because you have, I'm thinking of that piece, Daddy, that you had for Splash Time. And so you have the cloud, then you have the actual frame, and then you have, like, layer upon layer upon layer. So you are kind of, like, falling down this, like, sort of rabbit hole and, like, experiencing more and more things in those layers. So
yeah.
It's really interesting. And also they're just a ton of thresholds. You pass one, you come to the next piece of content, you pass one.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting.
Yeah, thanks. And I think that with that too, within each individual piece, I tend to work in bodies of work. And then I think within each individual piece, like what you're talking about, I think of as access points. I always want my work to be accessible to a broad audience initially. Like I think that I always want the lay person, I'm doing air quotes, the lay person to be able to access the work and engage with it, and whether they're like, that's beautiful, that's disturbing, whatever mm-hmm, it is, mm-hmm. that's funny. I use yeah. humor a lot. I want there to be that initial take, and then if you spend more time with it, you discover, and then there's layers, and if you're, you know, if you're into the same kind of theory or academics or whatever it is, like that, if you're, that there are other layers and points of engagement and access points within each piece. And then I think with the threshold, like with that daddy piece, it's interesting that you went there. Because to me, it's before that even, it's the lights. You know what I mean?
Like the space kind of, itself.
Yeah, with that show for the space, I installed 16 bright yellow LED lights that were like kind of layered stripes, almost like an arcade that you enter under to step into the show. Mm-hmm. And I think that to me, like that, that's the threshold. And then you go to a piece
you're in a new
and then
space.
It's like layer.
Yeah. That's so interesting.
Okay, guys, Leslie and I are continuing to talk about her practice. I'm asking her about the visual indicators within her work. We're going to go over Tropical Contemporary, her show there, how she uses shag rugs and neon lights to really transport people into a new space. And we also talk about the importance of language and words next to each other and how certain context changes the way that language activates. So let's go ahead and listen. Just a heads up, we have some extraneous noise in the background. That's just a ladder moving. It's a working studio, just so you guys are aware. Man, I thinking about just access points, or like you said, that just small indicator that we're in a new space by just indicating by the lights that are kind of coming mm-hmm. down, by changing that sort of perception there, you do have a completely different experience. You access the work completely differently.
Yeah. And I think it gets people excited. I had a show in March at Tropical Contemporary in mm-hmm. Eugene, and I shut off all the gallery lights and only used these like red, pink, and orange fluorescents. They're actually LEDs throughout the space. And I had a fog machine going, and the opening was at night. And it's kind of like around the hallway. Like I deliberately did not address their entrance at all and just had all of the lights off. So you had to like walk through this like weird dark entrance where you're like, am I
in the right place?
Yeah. Like, is this correct?
Yeah.
But you knew it was because before you even entered into their first space from the street, all you could see was a pink glow looming through like two doors down.
Oh, that's cool.
And the fog rolling out. So you knew something was going on, but you weren't sure what it was.
Yeah.
I think it's really fun. And with all of those, whenever I'm using light, there's the entering of the space. And then there's also the exiting, which is really interesting too. Thinking about with that shag show in Eugene, when you left, everything looked green. All of a sudden, you're like, oh, my God, everything's so green. And it's because your eyes adjusted to the pink light in the space or the red light in the space. And then when you leave, then there's this, like, re-entering into the real world.
I wish there was – this makes me think of, like, those like long movies that you would see, they'd be about 4 hours. By the time you get up out of the movie, everything's changed from your perception outside. You have to like kind of readjust that experience.
Yes. I love that movie theater effect.
Yeah. They purposely, you have an atmosphere and ambiance that transports you so you can access all that material in a really condensed way so that you're not disregarding what's happening.
And yeah.
So yeah. That's I love that. I know I think similarly to you in the fact that I really always want to start off with a visceral effect and then kind of lead people in the work in more conceptual ways. Because I feel like if you don't have that sort of body transformation, if you're not able to get into it, whether that be in the beauty of it or the sort of the rejection of it, or like, you know, if you don't have some sort of visceral thing to kind of tap into or common materials to access, you might not ever go there to kind of contemplate it. So I like that you're using those techniques.
Yeah. And just thinking about broadening the art market in and of itself and like what art even means.
Yeah.
Right. And thinking about just like, is it just this elitist thing for super rich people, or like can kindergartners engage with this work? Can, you know, whoever, can anybody engage with this work?
Totally.
So in this next clip, I asked Leslie about what her studio process is like, how she gets started, how she decides to work on a piece, how she decides to put a piece away. And she has some pretty interesting ritualistic ways that she approaches a practice. So let's go ahead and listen. Take us through a day in your studio. What does it look like?
A day in my studio is messy, I would say. So it begins with cleaning. There's a lot of stuff down there. Yeah.
I'm like, me too.
I think that like every time I go down, I need to re-nest. Yeah. And depending on how long it's been since I've been in there, it's a, you know, 15, 10 minute fix. And sometimes it's like a full hour of restructuring. But the first steps are always putting on an apron or something with pockets and popping in my earphones and lighting a candle. And then
you have a very ritualistic, you know, beginning.
Yeah, I guess so. It didn't, you know, a lot of it's out of necessity. The apron's because I like to have headphones on. The headphones are because I don't want to hear anybody else. And the candle's because I'm often in a basement. And I'm like,
you got to have a little mood in there.
I just need to like, make it seem warmer, I think, and not smell like a basement. So I think that, and it's nice.
Yeah.
And it keeps me on my toes, too, because I have to make sure I'm not too messy and setting my house on fire. Yeah. I'm knocking on wood.
That was a knock on wood for real. It's real wood.
Real wood. Real knock.
So, like, once you get started, once you get that momentum moving and you got your apron on, you got your candle lit, like, where do you go from there?
I normally just dive in. I'm a real headfirst kind of person, just swan dive, so depending on what I'm working on, I'll just sit down and literally work for hours on end without stopping. And it's like the flow, right? A lot of people talk about it, that they get into some kind of meditative state. So I'll realize at some point that my music's not playing anymore or my podcast ended. And I'll have this moment where I'm like, wait, when did that even stop? Like it might have been off for 20 minutes. And it just really depends on, my work varies a lot. Materially, conceptually, in terms of scale. So depending on what I'm working on at that moment, it'll shift. But generally, it's like, once I get locked in, I'll sit down and go.
Do you have those moments where you have something that you're like, that was just a day, but I learned something from it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Like, often, I'd say. Yeah, I'll finish something, and then I'll be like, oh. But I feel like I'll drive myself to bring it to basically completion, 90% done at least. And then I feel like if it's not working, I'll push through it to try to make, like you were saying, discoveries. And even if that discovery is, this isn't working. Officially, it's official. It's basically done and totally not functioning. Next, you know, and then that's fine. And then that's normally when I'll go to the bathroom or get
like, take a break. Or you're something. Like, oh, I need something.
So in this next clip, I asked Leslie about a skill that's primary to her process. This has been really interesting asking this question because each artist has come up with a different answer, but most of the skills that artists have talked about aren't skills that they've learned. It's not skills that they've been taught at a workshop. It's skills that are inherent to their person, what they're good at inside, or how they bring themselves into their art practice. So let's listen to Leslie's skill. Let's listen to what she brings to the table.
I've gotten some really interesting answers on this question, so we'll see about how you approach this. But tell us about a skill that's primary to your process. It's such a hard one, because a skill can be anything.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of a more... I thought about this ahead of time, and the main thing I thought about was... I mean, is InDesign a skill? I guess it's a software.
It could be a skill.
I think planning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a planner.
Yeah.
I think that is a critical part of my process and really primary to it. Percolating, thinking, reflecting, and I think witnessing.
Mm.
A lot of my work is based off of pop culture and interpersonal relationships. Like, I think I'm a hard person to date for many reasons. And one of them is that, like, my work is constantly reflecting my thoughts and feelings and emotional status around relationships with people. So I think that, like, in terms of a step-by-step process in design and just mapping things out and thinking about things in a graphic, digital way and then translating them with the hand is a critical part. But then I think witnessing and reflecting people.
Totally.
Hey guys, we're listening to episode 6 of Script. I'm Brittany and I'm your host. And we are talking to artist Leslie Vigen. In this next clip, I'm asking Leslie how she generates or starts an idea, how she gets everything kind of flowing or moving. And for her, she talks a lot about how language plays a role, how she does a lot of wordsmithing before she gets things moving. So let's go ahead and listen. Pretty interesting stuff.
To start off, I want to kind of know, how do you start to generate an idea? How do you generate a project?
So fun.
So fun?
Systematic, yeah. It really starts with an exchange. It really starts with something happened. Witness something or something happened to me. Something happens that triggers an idea. And that idea is generally words plus image to me.
Yeah.
And then I'll create lists of words. And then I'll pull them and create a hierarchy. And then I'll define them. Like, what does that mean to me?
Wow.
And then
that's pretty cool.
That's the basis of the work. That's like the backboard for me. Like every decision will be like, is this supporting that? I basically try to like develop like the essence of the project through language first. And then I'll make mood boards on Pinterest.
You're like, boom, boom, boom. This looks great.
And I'll come up and I'll develop the visual vocabulary basically. So I'll have an idea. And I'll have a visual in my mind, obviously. And then I'll just generate visual fodder for me, again, to reflect on and think about, like, what is the vibe? And a lot of that comes down to what is the best way to communicate this message? So this is also how I begin to, like, decipher what are the materials of this project and what is the best way to communicate to the audience.
Yeah.
Like, does this communicate that to them? So I'll do kind of that work first.
Yeah.
And that's the beginning.
I think that's so nice that you're not like marrying yourself to particular materials or processes.
Oh, yeah.
And that you just allow the idea to kind of define that for you.
Yeah.
Because then the materials inherently mean a lot more, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's really critical. I think that's really critical in work is to have the material speak to the message. I mean, I know a lot of like ceramicists. I have a lot of friends that are like, I'm a ceramicist. And that's the given. That's like the constant for them.
Yeah.
And I just don't function like that. And I think it's okay. I mean, I find it exciting.
I don't function like that either. I wish that sometimes I could decide on something and kind of tap into like a sort of a really like intense practice at something to really master it. But I feel like my practice totally relies on that fluidity, relies on the idea defining what it is. And also, I think, especially, you know, we're professors, we obviously love learning and teaching.
Yeah.
And so I think also part of that growth is like trying new things and not being a professional at it, not being so good at it that I don't think about it anymore. Like that I just apply that process.
Yeah.
I want to be able to like challenge what that process can do. And I think once you get too good at something, maybe you start dialing it into a single kind of output or something.
Yeah. And I think it's like still professional.
Yeah.
But I think that like what you're talking about is mastery.
Yeah.
And I do have things, and I think you do too, definitely, that you are a master of, that you're masterful with. And it might be ideas and it might be a material. And I think the other thing that you're pointing out, too, is, like, comfort. Like, slipping into being comfortable with something.
Yeah.
And I think that that's, like, why I not stopped painting, but stopped exclusively painting, is because I could just do it.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I can just execute that. And it wasn't as challenging. And it's not always appropriate, right?
Yeah.
I don't know about you guys, but I definitely can get down with a bunch of different materials, a bunch of different mediums. I love working with a bunch of different things, so I like hearing that there's other artists out there that don't feel quite married to a process. And I think that's really refreshing, because you see these craftsmen, these people that I deeply admire, deeply respect, just really stick to one practice, one craft, and become masters of it. And I've always felt a sort of deficit in the fact that I didn't do that. But I love talking with Leslie about that. Within the next clip, I asked Leslie about research versus production. What's more important to her practice? So let's listen. How much time is spent with research versus production?
I think I research way longer.
Yeah.
I just think about stuff for like a year or 6 months, and I'll normally give myself like 3 months to make the body of work.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's healthy or not, but that's kind of the way I'll do it, is I'll think about things. A lot of the work is cumulative, although it may not appear to be that way. A lot of the ideas are linked together, but I think about it for a really long time.
When are we not thinking about it, probably?
When are we not thinking? I know, yeah. What about, can I ask, like, for you, what's your...
Oh, it's research all day, every day.
Yeah.
You know, I'm constantly... I have, hundreds of ideas on the back burner, but, you know, it takes me a while to figure out which one I should situate on, you know,
yeah.
Like, and what's really worth my time. I've been thinking about putting together an installation with all these molds, these casts that are broken. And it's going to happen.
Yeah.
But I keep marinating on it until it's like, I know I want to output it, you know?
I have something to show you later.
Okay.
Yeah.
What is it?
It's not, I mean, just looking at these, I was like, oh yeah, it's this place, in Joshua Tree that I just went to called, I think it's called Christ Park. And it's this guy that was like a religious fanatic that built these just like huge outsider artist, like 20 foot, 12 foot sculptures of kind of like religious vignettes. And this kind of, this is like mini Acropolis looking structure. And I was like, I went with my friend Jill, and I was like pretty uncomfortable the whole time, and she kept being like, why are you freaking out? And I was like, I don't know,
these are just too massive in scale and crazy.
Oh, just like creepy. I was just like imagining like the dead, like the souls of like children captured, yeah, in these sculptures. Like, but anyways, I think like I'm looking at your molds right now, and I'm like, oh man, you should totally check this thing out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's really interesting, especially when you take things that are remnants of other things, because they have past lives, past history, yeah, past all this stuff, so they hold this inherent power within them. And I was just thinking about a studio practice. I mean, some of these molds are 6 years old, some of them are 10, some of them come from other places that are 50 years old, you know?
Yeah.
And so, like, mashing all that history together, I think is really interesting.
Yeah.
And creating a flat, two-dimensional thing that gets compressed.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So in these next few clips, I'm going to switch gears a little bit. I'm going to ask some professional practice questions. And in this next question, I'm asking Leslie, what are some things she's learned over time as a professional artist? Like, what can she offer us as things learned over time? So let's give that a listen.
The first question I kind of wanted to ask is, can you share some things that you've learned over time working as an artist, or something that you were kind of surprised by even?
I mean, I think that the most important thing that I've learned is that community is the most important thing. Creating a network, being there for people, yeah, showing up, not always thinking about what can somebody do for me, but
yeah,
thinking about what can I do to help other people. I think that that's the most critical thing.
Yeah.
Being an artist isn't working in a vacuum. It isn't you, like, existing in a singular manner, mm-hmm, where somebody's going to discover you. Like, that,
yeah,
isn't the reality anymore. So I think, if it ever was. So I think that the most important thing is that your practice is not just you in your studio, that it's a really dynamic ecosystem that, mm-hmm, doesn't include just you, but your friends and family and the people that support you, and acknowledging them, and then creating new connections and showing up. I think that that is something that I figured out on my own and really push my students to be aware of.
Yeah.
I think it's really important.
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, not that I ever thought artists work in a silo, but I don't think that's something that people really talk about when you're trying to be an artist and you're thinking a lot about what you're doing in your practice, but it's super crucial.
Yeah.
To even your personal growth, you know?
Yeah. I think the other thing I really learned that I think is really important is being okay with making a living off of your work. I think that's another thing that they don't talk about or teach you. And we feel this guilt. And I think that there's this, and I'm hugely, huge problem that I have. I think a lot of artists do is like, we all like work so much and talk about how we work so much. And like, it's this badge of honor thing. And I think that it's really important for artists. And like, I don't know when I'm going to figure this out, but for us all to be kind to ourselves and understand that we're just like little weak humans or something.
Yeah, or we're like humans like lifting buildings all the time, you know?
Yeah.
Doing six things at a time.
Yeah, and I think it's like important, and so I haven't learned this yet, but to understand that like, I mean, we all know like, oh, like fail fast and like it's okay to fail within our practice, but I think that as a person, I think it's not a sprint.
Yeah.
It's, I don't know, a long run. What do they even call that in track? To, like, carry the metaphor.
Long distance.
Like
a long distance.
Yeah. It's like an endurance thing.
Yeah.
I feel like art is endurance.
Yeah.
It's enduring failure. It's enduring rejections. It's enduring highs and lows and stimulating thoughts and losses of people and work and selling work and not selling work. And I think that if you're going to be an artist, you need to be strong because there's so much endurance involved, and being okay and kind to yourself, and then also when it's necessary, kicking yourself in the butt.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, like how do you make it sustainable if the whole time you're like guilt-ridding yourself because you're not doing enough?
Yeah, or overworking yourself.
Or overworking yourself, yeah.
So I think that that's a really important thing, is, and that's kind of like why the workshop that I'm going to do is what it is.
Yeah.
Because I think that I have certain things I do in my life that heal me.
Yeah.
And I think that as an artist, as a creative, you know, to battle that starving artist thing or whatever it is, we all work really hard. We all love what we do, so we don't count it as work all the time. But
yeah,
I think it's important to take care of yourself, too.
Totally.
This is episode 6 of Script. We're continuing some professional practice questions. This next question talks about how she sifts through opportunities. She talks about something called the spray method, which I've never heard that term before, but pretty interesting. So let's listen.
How do you sift through opportunities and decide what to embark on?
Yeah, I think that's another thing that as artists, like, we always say yes. It's like, yes, I can do that. Yes, I can do that. Even like, I like that dress. Oh, I can just make it. Like, it's like a whole scene that we combat with, like, pretty constantly. But I think with opportunities, in the beginning, I would just take anything I could get and I would apply to everything. And it's called like the spray method. You know what I mean?
We
just like, just like spray, like just try to hit as many things as you can. And I think that now I'm definitely more targeted. I'd rather have a really quality opportunity that I can spend a lot of time on. I think that a reality that I have to say to myself is like, if I can't do it fully, I don't want to do it. Like, I'm an all or nothing kind of person. So I think that it's important to find galleries that you identify with, that carry your work and carry a message. If you have an ethic or an ethos to your practice, to work with people that have a similar one.
Yeah.
I definitely had exchanges like years ago with people that were not positive.
Yeah.
And in hindsight, I could have avoided that by acknowledging that I don't agree fundamentally with what this person or their space stands for.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it also goes back to community in terms of like finding the things, the galleries, the residencies, the opportunities. It's like knowing people and saying, hey, this is the kind of work I make. Do you know anywhere I could be showing? One great thing for research is just looking at people whose work you like and then seeing where they show.
Yeah.
And then looking at that gallery and thinking if your work fits in.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of it has to do with like being present and being active.
Well, and it's exciting to have opportunities or relationships with galleries too that kind of see this as an equal partnership. I think there's more of those that are kind of probably at the same threshold as you're showing work that are really able to like go the mile for you. You know, I was talking with another artist just about how I did all this output for a show, didn't get advertised at all. It was like, okay, now it exists on the internet. That's great. And it's on my CV, but it was really kind of a certain amount of labor was invested for very little labor back, which you know, happens sometimes, you know. But I was talking to them about how I want to be more careful in the future of like making sure that we're all on the same page. We stand for the same things.
Yeah.
Or we're interested in reaching the same audience or like maybe making a message really clear to people, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was a great way of saying that is like having similar, you know, values.
Yeah,
you know,
for sure.
Yeah,
I definitely don't have it figured out. You know, like, I'm like talking like I have this authority, but like I, you know, feel lucky to be showing as much as I am. But I'm also like the hardest thing is jumping to the next level. I think that's always growing pains are called that for a reason, and I think that whenever I also have just like really bad anxiety. So whenever I'm doing something with people that I'm like, oh my God, they're like on the next level. I always call my friends and I'm like, it's like I'm with the big fish this time.
Yeah.
You know, and like feeling out of place and then giving yourself permission to be like, no, I belong here.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, I don't know if you were like this, but it took me like years to call myself an artist. Like I didn't feel legit to say like, what do you do? I'm an artist. Like it took me a really long time. And that's why earlier when you were like, when we were talking about mastery and you were like, oh, it's not professional or whatever you said in passing, I knew what you meant, but I was kind of like, that's why I kind of wanted to stick to that. Cause I was like, no man, like we worked so hard that, and anyways, that's totally tangential.
I mean, galleries, you know, I might've got an MFA because I needed that you know, I've got an MFA and enjoy my MFA, but it was all about that qualifier, you know, and then it's like, maybe I'll get a PhD and then that will bring me up to that next level. You know, you're constantly, I guess because the standards of next level are really self-identified versus other industries where maybe it's identified by a title or identified by some sort of, you know, recognition somewhere. And I think for us, it's all self-gathering. And so it's constant, you know, but then you got to tell yourself, no, I am here because I put in the work, because I am a professional.
I do belong
here. Okay. Hello.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I feel you. Yeah. So what can't you stop thinking about? What is it in your practice that you are just stuck on, or you're marinating over for days and days or years and years? I feel like I constantly think I'm progressing, but I'm dealing with the same stuff over and over and over again, thinking about the same thing that I've been thinking about for the last 10 years. The output's just different. In this next section, I talk to Leslie about what she can't stop thinking about. We have a really interesting conversation about wood paneling and those sort of cultural signifiers and signifiers of status and wealth and sort of economic prosperity and how materials really have inherent meaning. So really cool stuff. Let's go ahead and listen. I'm going to feed you right in. So what is something you can't stop thinking about right now?
Wood paneling! I'm obsessed. I just really want to do an installation with wood paneling. But I think I just scored some via text during the break, so that's good. But I don't know yet what this work is going to look like, but I do have some ideas, and I need to start wordsmithing. Yeah. I wrote a proposal for a show recently that involved it. And I guess I could have buffed up on it before I came today. But I'm really pumped about wood paneling.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, as far as a material, God, it has so much resonance with, like, man-made plastics. And when you think about, sure. like, what plastic is for America at a particular time.
Yeah. You know? And I think I, the thing I'm really feeling about it is, like, the local flavor. Mm-hmm. Being from New England, I mean, I've been here for 10 years now, so I think after 10 years you're a local.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty sure I'm a local at this point. I'm sure anybody from Oregon would be like, no, you're not. But I love here in Portland, in the Pacific Northwest, like, wood paneling is just everywhere.
Yeah.
And there's that dive bar aesthetic with, mm-hmm. like, wood paneling, mm-hmm. neon lights, and then, like, hot chick posters with, like, Miller Lite or something.
You're like, where are we?
And
oh, yeah.
That, yeah, like, and, you know, like, dive bars have been cool, like, hipster for a long time now, and I think that something I'm interested in is picking apart what does that aesthetic really mean. We were talking yeah. earlier about, like, white nationalism and all this kind of, like, fucked up, I said it on the podcast, I dropped an F-bomb, fucked up stuff that's happening in society right now, and thinking about, like, what does that aesthetic mean in terms of misogyny and racism, and how can I, as, like, a woman artist, Portuguese, like, whatever, mm-hmm. how can I reclaim that look for myself? So I don't really know. Wood paneling, you know, red lights, fog, shag carpets, digital prints, all of those things, cinder blocks. Are coming in the mix. I don't know what. I had other words pop into my head just now. I didn't say them. But some other really weird shit just popped into my head. So thinking about, like, how can I... Yeah, use the idea of the threshold to create an environment that takes an environment that we're really familiar with, mm-hmm. and in most cases comfortable with across many socioeconomic divisions, and how can we flip it?
Yeah, totally. I mean, what's so great about, in particular, wood paneling is not only is it associated with all those places you were talking about, it's regionally specific in a way.
Yeah, definitely.
And also, like, in itself, it's a strange simulacra of the thing. Like, it's representing something else that isn't there, so it has this inherent meaning. Yes. Like, it's a faux wood. It's supposed to, like, resemble, like, cabin aesthetic in a way, or, like, weird other things. And so there's all this, like, imbued sort of... five steps over meaning within the materiality of that thing. So I think it's so interesting that you're going to be talking about those subject matters, how they're kind of five steps away from us actually dealing with any of those issues, but they're kind of situated in these spaces in weird ways.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And I love plasticity. It's something I almost always have in my show. Yeah. There's always like a trompe l'oeil or some kind of fault thing that's referencing something else, like the billboards that are digitally printed like clouds, right? That's an example of that.
Yeah.
So I think that the wood paneling is like the idea of, like, the facade or the veneer. It all feeds into the concept. So I'm really pumped. It's like the beginning of it. I've done a little bit of writing and I need to do more, but that's, like, something I'm really interested in investigating. And then thinking in the long, like, big picture, what happens if that show travels? Like, what happens if that...
Yeah.
That's kind of something I'm really interested in. It's, like, building the work here and then, like, bringing it to New York or bringing it somewhere where we're less involved with it.
Yeah.
You know, on a daily basis where it's, like, less integrated into our lives.
What's so interesting about that is being from another place as well, like, building construction totally has a different meaning based on material usage in that place too. Like, New England is probably similar to where I grew up, where it's brick. It's like classical, like, older buildings that have, you know, that are really solid looking brick kind of buildings, or these two stories with beautiful wood that are from the 1920s.
That's it. Yeah, shingles and stone walls and you know, there's, like, a judgment that happens with materials.
Yeah.
I think as artists we deal with that all the time too. Totally. Like the digital print's a really interesting thing because it's not an oil painting, right?
Yeah.
And, like, concrete's really interesting because it's not porcelain. And I think a lot of artists are engaging with materials and questioning, like, the value of them.
Yeah.
right now, and I totally. Think it's pretty exciting. Yes. Anyways, that's what I'm pumped on.
I'm so excited.
Wood paneling.
Yeah. I'm so excited. In these next few clips, I'm going to talk to Leslie about the other outputs that kind of feed into her studio practice, like the music she listens to or the books that she's reading. And we're also going to talk about what's on the horizon and talk about, you know, what's in the future for her as an artist. So let's go ahead and start right in. Okay, so some light questions light. What do you listen to in your studio?
Podcasts. Oh, it depends, but I listen to a lot of podcasts. I listen to almost every body of work. This is a sick thing that I do. Has a soundtrack to it. And sometimes it's a playlist. Sometimes it's a single song.
Oh, sometimes. You define it. You're like, this is for this body of work.
It happens. And then I realize it's like the only thing all of a sudden I listen to. This is sick. So for my Shag show, it was Gossip Girl.
You were just like all over it. Yeah.
The whole series was on in the background.
That's so funny.
The entire series.
That's so funny.
Like a couple shows ago, it was like a Solange album. Years ago, I had this one Bach song, this like cello Bach song. And that's literally all I listened to was this one like 5 minute song on repeat. For hours on end, for days on end, for weeks on end.
Wow.
It was like the song. I don't know why I do that. It's kind of, the only thing I can like maybe associate it with is like when you have like, oh, I'm really into like, you know, green smoothies right now. Like I have a smoothie every day because it's like the thing you crave. You're like, I just want.
Well, it creates a sort of habit or a habitual thing too, where you're like back in the studio, I'm back in the same headspace, I'm listening to the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. It goes back to the ritual, I guess, like to the first question too. And then I'll always unpack to myself, you know, like you're like, I don't really share this with people, but I'll always like unpack like, what is it about that?
So every artist has different inputs they rely on. And so we've talked about music and how music can influence the practice. We've talked about how that puts you in a certain headspace. And now we're going to talk about literature and books and how books can kind of inform a practice. So we're going to talk with Leslie about which books influence her practice. Make sure to stay tuned because we're going to also talk about what's on the horizon in her practice. And I have hard dates for all the workshops. So I have dates. I have the number of slots that are available. They are limited and they're free workshops hosted by every one of these script artists that we're recording. So please stay tuned so you can get those deets. Okay, let's feed you back in. Okay, so next question. Books or writings you can tell us about that influence your work?
Yeah, that was a confusing one. I was like, oh God, like what do I? I mean, I've read a lot of theory. Like, I feel like I can, get down with some Flisser or something, Bachelard. I think that one writing that I really like is, it's called A Breakfast at the Victory by James P. Carse, and it's about this, like, one-armed guy that runs a diner in New York. Huh. And it's just kind of about his, like, ritual and his exchanges. It's just an interesting short read that I'll like revisit sometimes, but I think it's just one of the things that like sits back there. I think that one of the things I like the most about the reading is that it is theory and philosophy, but it's really accessible and it's very everyday. And that you can read it on multiple different levels. I've been reading for like a year, like basically one page a month. Some Carl Jung, his stuff is super interesting about dreams and the subconscious.
Yeah.
But that is something, admittedly, that I feel like I can't even appropriately speak to.
Yeah.
Because I'll read it and then I'll really think about it for a while and then it'll dissolve almost. Yeah. And then I'll pick it back up. I've been reading a lot of beach reads lately. I'm an avid reader, actually, but I just... I've just been reading a lot of crap.
Hey, whatever. That also feeds into things. You know what I mean? Like, anything. Like, I was talking to somebody else about, you know, for me, sometimes it's all about skill learning, you know? So instead of reads, it's YouTube videos or something that I'm just... beefing up skills. Yeah. Or I read this whole glaze book from cover to cover to just technical expertise. Yeah. And
I do think, I mean, podcasts have are where I'm learning a lot right now.
I'm really
listening to podcasts.
I love that because you can also be accessible in the studio while you're taking it in.
Yeah.
It's you don't have to like separate your time, sit down, do this thing, and put one thing away. You can do both at the same time.
Yeah.
Totally. Hey guys, we're listening to episode 6 of Script, and I'm talking to Leslie Vigen. And we're going to talk about things on the horizon. And sometimes I forget, you know, On the Horizon just isn't just a show, isn't an exhibition, isn't a grant, isn't an art-related thing. We're humans, we're people, we're fully holistic people that aren't always about an art practice. So Leslie gives us a little bit of what's on the horizon in her art practice and also talks about some personal journeys that she's going to take this coming year. So let's go ahead and listen. Pretty cool stuff. Where are you headed now? Anything cool on the horizon?
This show.
Yeah.
Super cool.
I'm so excited for you to be in it.
I'm super pumped about this and the workshop. I have I'm going to be in a group show at Stephanie Chafa's project.
Oh, okay.
In July.
All right.
Which will be really great. The Art Back show when that happens in LA.
July.
Also July, big month.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to Portugal, which I'm really excited about, with my family. I've never been.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So like my mom's side, from my mom's side, and then also the entire town I grew up in is from, it's called the Azores. It's like a string of islands off the coast of Portugal. They're like basically in the middle of the Atlantic. And they're tropical. And everything that I think I identify with as a child was from the Azores. Like, everybody's from the Azores. Everybody, I look, I'm like 4'11".
Yeah.
Like, I look like it. They're very kind people. A lot of fishermen, which makes sense. And I did grow up, like, on the ocean. And Portuguese food is a huge part of my life. Like, food is a huge part of my life and my family. And it's like, it's garlic and it's wine and it's pork and shellfish and cheese and espresso.
Yum.
And it's coming together all of the time. Like, my family all of the time comes together, whether if it's the four of us or the five of us or five and a half now, Paxton's like 1.5. Or if it's, like, my 30 cousins, or if it's my whole family, which is just this slew of people. I mean, we're, like, half the town, practically. We come together around food all of the time, and I'm really excited to like, engage with the home base of my home base.
Yeah.
So that's something that I'm, like, really thinking about.
Wow, that's going to be really amazing.
I can't
Because you haven't been back.
I've never been.
Never been. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I've never been. And when I was studying, like, languages in high school, I had the options of, like, what do you want to study? And I chose French because my dad's French-Canadian. And I thought that was, like, exotic or something. And then only after I left did I realize that being Portuguese isn't everywhere, like, ubiquitous. Yeah. Like, I just totally thought it was so normal to me. It was so much of my life. It was, I was fully immersed in, like, this American Azorean culture that it totally was confusing to me. The first time somebody was like, wait, you're other? You know?
Yeah.
It happened when I went to college, right? That was the first time that somebody was like, that's different.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited to go. And of course, when I go, I'm going to realize, like, how much of a, like, faker American I am, and that I'm, like, zero. I'm this, like, plastic ripoff or something of
whatever
what actually Portuguese means. But I'm really excited to go.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you so much. Fun. It was really fun. Thank you.
You were wonderful to talk to.
Oh, man.
Okay.
Smiles.
Okay, guys, this has been incredible for me. I have learned so much about my studio practice. I've learned about being an artist. I've learned about, you know, what kinds of opportunities to take on, what opportunities to not, how to take care of yourself mainly. I think that's what I'm worst at. I hope you've learned a ton too. We are culminating into an exhibition June 1st, next month at Carnation Contemporary in Portland, Oregon. So come on out, meet some great artists, introduce yourself. We'll have a great time, look at some amazing artwork. Also, this whole month of June coming up, June 1st is the opening, but June 2nd, we have a ceramic donut making workshop. That's what Sarah Hummel Jones is really famous for, is their ceramic donuts. You get to come to the workshop, learn how she hand builds these objects, and make some of your own. And I'm going to fire it for you, and it's a freebie takeaway. So super fun there. We're going to have donuts to eat and model after. It's going to be an amazing time on June 2nd. Hannah Newman, the following weekend, is hosting an amazing workshop on the 8th, and it's going to be a cloud watching workshop, and we're going to talk about the digital cloud and how sort of digital terrain is kind of labeled after or named after these really earthly experiences. And so we're going to be watching clouds and talking about the digital cloud. Pretty amazing. June 15th is a dual workshop with Catherine Spinella, who's an amazing screen printer, and Haji Quinn, who is a poet and a writer, and they're hosting a workshop called Writing the Script, where they're going to combine screen printing and writing. And it's just going to be incredible. Really amazing workshop where we think about text and language within visual formats. Following weekend, I've got Katie Zasinski, and she's going to talk about contextualizing objects, and we're going to do a workshop where we organize and categorize objects and think about objects in different ways. She's an amazing thinker. And the final weekend, that following weekend, June 28th, we are going to have some wine. We're going to have a closing reception. We are going to make homemade pasta with Leslie. And she decided, you know what? This is how I relax. This is what makes me happy outside of my artistic practice. I want to bring this in as a workshop to the gallery. So each artist has cultivated and curated their own workshop. And so for this final reception, what better to have wine and homemade pasta made by the artists and some great conversation. So please join us. Sign up on the website at www.digitalexhibition.com, and we look forward to seeing you there. Thanks for supporting us. Thanks for supporting amazing artists. I really appreciate all of you guys. See you guys next year.